Onarin drove her weapon like a fish spear. Tane leapt backwards, giving her a wide berth. Then, when Onarin raised her arm for a final downcut, Tane rolled and swung hard for her weak knee. Wood snapped cleanly against bone. Onarin skidded with a gasp. Her knees gave way. Before she could rise, Tane had set her blade across her shoulders.
"Rise," said the sea general, sounding pleased.
"Well fought.
Honorable Tane of the South House, victory is yours."
The spectators applauded. Tane handed the halberd to a servant and extended a hand to Onarin.
"Did I hurt you?"
Onarin let Tane help her up.
"Well," she said, panting, "I suspect you've broken my kneecap."
A puff of briny air came from behind them. The green lacustrine dragon was grinning at Tane over the rooftop, showing all her teeth. For the first time, Tane smiled back. Distantly, she realized that Onarin was still speaking.
"Sorry," she said, lightheaded with joy. "What did you say?" "I was only observing how the fiercest warriors can hide behind such gentle faces."
They bowed to each other before Onarin nodded to the benches, where the apprentices were still clapping.
"Take a good look at Tarusa. He knows he has a fight on his hands."
Tane followed her gaze. Tarusa had never looked so angry, nor so determined. Chapter 11. West.
"There it is,"
Istina Milago said with a sweeping gesture towards land.
"Feast your eyes on the draconic cesspit of Iskarlin."
"No, thank you." Kit drank from the bottle they were sharing. "I would much rather my death was a surprise." Loth peered through the spyglass. Even now, a day after seeing the High Western, his hands were unsteady. Fyrdell, right wing of the Nameless One, commander of the Draconic Army. If he had woken, then the other High Westerns would surely follow. It was from them that the rest of Wormkind drew strength. When a High Western died, the fire in its wyverns and their progeny burned out. The Nameless One himself could not return, not while the House of Berethnet stood, but his servants could wreak destruction without him. The grief of ages had proven that. There had to be a reason they were rising again. They had fallen into their slumber at the end of the grief of ages, the same night a comet had crossed the sky. Scholars had speculated for centuries as to why and to when they might wake, but no one had found an answer. Gradually, everyone had begun to assume that they never would, that the worms had become living fossils. Loth returned his attention to what he could glimpse through the spyglass. The moon was a half-closed eye, and they floated on water as dark as his thoughts. All he could see was the nest of lights that was Perunta, a place that might be crawling with draconic plague. The sickness had first oozed from the Nameless One, whose breath, it was said, had been a slow-acting poison. A more fearsome strain had arrived with the five High Westerns. They and their wyverns carried it, the same way rats had once carried the pestilence. It had existed only in pockets since the end of the grief of ages, but Loth knew the signs from books. It began with the reddening of hands, then a scale-like rash. As it tiptoed over the body, the afflicted would experience pain in the joints, fever, and visions. If they were unlucky enough to survive this stage, the blood blaze set in. They were at their most dangerous then, for if not restrained, they would run about screaming as if they were on fire, and anyone whose skin touched theirs would also be afflicted. Usually they died within days, though some had been known to survive longer. There was no cure for the plague. No cure and no protection. Loth snapped the spyglass close and handed it to Milago.
"I suppose this is it," he said.
"Don't abandon hope, Lord Arteloth." Her gaze was detached. "I doubt the plague will be in the palace. It's those of us you call the commons who suffer most in times of need."
Plume and Harlow were approaching the bow, the latter with a clay pipe in hand.
"Right, my lords," the captain said. "We've enjoyed having you, truly, but nothing lasts forever."
Kit finally seemed to grasp the danger they were in. Either he was cupshotten or he had lost his wits, but he clasped his hands.
"I beseech you, Captain Harlow, let us join your crew."
His eyes were fevered.
"You need not tell Lord Satan. Our families have money."
"What?" Loth hissed. "Kit!"
"Let him speak,"
Harlow motioned with his pipe.
Carry on, Lord Kitson.
There is land in the Downs. Good land. Save us, and it's yours, Kit continued.
I have the high seas at my feet. Land is not what I need, Harlow said. What I need is seafarers.
With your guidance, I wager we could be outstanding seafarers. I come from a long line of cartographers, you know. An outright lie. And Artaloth used to sail on Elson Lake.
Harlow regarded them with dark eyes.
No, Loth said firmly. Captain, Lord Kitson is uneasy about our task, but we are duty-bound to enter Iskallen, to see that justice is done.
With a face like a skinned apple, Kit seized him by the jerkin and pulled him aside.
Artaloth, he said under his breath, I am trying to get us out of this, because this,
he turned Loth towards the lights in the distance,
has nothing to do with justice. This is the Nighthawk, sending us both to our deaths for a penny worth of gossip.
Kor may have exiled me for some ulterior purpose, but now I stand on the brink of Iskallen. I wish to find out what happened to Prince Wilston.
Loth placed a hand on his shoulder. If you want a turn back, Kit, I will bear you no ill will. This was not your punishment.
Kit looked at him, frustration etched onto him.
Oh, Loth, he said softer. You're not the saint.
No, but he has got balls, Malargo said.
I have no time for this pious talk, Harlow cut in. But I do concur with Estina on the subject of your balls, Lord Artaloth. His gaze was piercing. I need people with hearts like yours. If you think you could weather the seas, say it now, and I'll put it to my crew.
Kit blinked. Really?
Harlow was expressionless. When Loth kept his peace, Kit sighed.
I thought not.
Harlow dealt them a cold stare.
Now, get the fuck off my ship.
The pirates jeered. Malargo, whose lips were pursed, beckoned to Loth and Kit. As his friend turned to follow, Loth gripped his arm.
Kit, he murmured, take the chance and stay behind. You are not a threat to Corm. Not like I am. You could still go back to Innis.
Kit shook his head, a smile on his lips.
Come now, Artaloth, he said. What little piety I have, I owe to you. And he might not be my patron, but I know the Knight of Fellowship tells us not to leave our friends alone.
Loth wanted to argue with him, but he found himself smiling back at his friend. They walked side by side after Malargo. They had to descend on a rope ladder from the Rose Eternal. Their polished boots slipped on the rungs. Once they were settled in the rowing boat, where their travelling chests waited, Malargo climbed in with them.
Hand me the oars, Lord Artaloth. When Loth did, she whistled. See you soon, Captain. Don't leave without me.
Never, Estina.
Harlow leaned over the side.
Farewell, my lords.
Keep those pomaders close, lordlings, Plume added. Wouldn't want you catching anything.
The crew roared with laughter as Malargo pushed away from the Rose.
Don't mind them. They'd piss themselves before they ever did what you're doing.
She glanced over her shoulder.
What made you offer up your services as a pirate, Lord Kitson? This life's not like it is in the songs, you know. There's a little more shit and scurvy.
A stroke of brilliance, I thought. Kit shot her a look of mock hurt.
I take the Knight of Curtsy as my patron mistress. She commands poets to beautify the world. But how can I, unless I see it?
There's a question I'd need a few more drinks to answer. As they drew closer to the shore, Loth took out his handkerchief and pressed it to his nose. Vinegar and fish and acrid smoke formed the rotten posy of Perunta. Kit kept up a smile, but his eyes were watering.
How refreshing, he managed.
Malargo did not smile.
Do keep those pomanders, she said. Worth having. If only for comfort.
Is there nothing we can do to protect ourselves?
Loth said. You can try not to breathe. Folks say the plague is everywhere and no one is sure how it spreads. Some wear veils or masks to keep it out.
Nothing else?
Oh, you'll see merchants peddling all sorts. Mirrors to deflect the foul vapours, countless potions and poultices. But you might as well swallow your gold. Best thing to do is put the afflicted out of their misery. She manoeuvred the boat around a rock.
I can't imagine you to have seen much death.
I resent your assumption, Kit objected. I saw my dear old aunt upon her bier.
Yes, and I suppose she wore a red gown for a meeting with the saint. I suppose she was as clean as a licked kitten and smelled of rosemary.
When Kit grimaced, Milagro said, You have not seen death, my lord. You have only seen the mask we put on it. They sat in silence from then on. When the water was shallow enough to wade in, Milagro stopped rowing.
I'll go no closer, she nodded to the city. You're to go to a tavern called Grapevine. Someone should collect you. She pushed Kit with the toe of her boot. Go, now.
I'm a privateer, not a milk nurse.
Loth stood.
Oh, thanks to you, Mistress Milagro. Your kindness will not be forgotten.
Please forget it. I've a reputation to uphold. They struck out from the boat with their chests. When they were both on the sand, dripping wet, Milagro sculled back to the Rose Eternal, singing in quavering Escali. Harlow might have taken them both. They could have seen places that no longer had names, oceans that had never been cross-stitched by trading routes. Loth could have found himself at the prow of his own ship one day, but he was not that man, and never would be.
Not our most dignified entrance.
Panting, Kit let his chest fall.
How do you suppose we find this tavern?
By relying on our instincts, Loth said, unsure. The commons must get on well enough.
Arteloff, we are courtiers. We have no useful instincts.
Loth had no counterstroke. They made slow progress into the city. Their chests were heavy, and they had neither map nor compass. Perunta had once been known as the most beautiful port in the west. These mud-clotted streets, overflowing with fishbones and ashes and swill, were not what Loth had imagined. A dead bird writhed with maggots. Cesspits overflowed. In one unlit square, a sanctuary lay in ruins. Sobran had heard reports that King Sagoso had executed the sanctarians who would not renounce the saint, but she had not wanted to believe them. Loth tried not to breathe as he stepped over a rivulet of dark liquid. He dared not stray too far from Kit. People jostled around them, shrouding their faces with veils or cloth rags. They saw their first plague house on the next street. Boards had been nailed over the windows, the oak door stained with scarlet wings. Escali words were chalked above it.
Pity this house, for here we are cursed, Kit read.
Loth looked askance at him.
You read Escali?
I know. You're shocked, Kit said gravely. After all, I am such a master of Inish, such a prodigy of verse, it seems impossible that I could have room in my skull for another language, but Kit...
Milagro told me the translation.
The darkness was disorientating. Few candles were lit in Perunta, though braziers fumigated the broader streets. By dint of striding about with as much confidence as possible, Loth and Kit finally happened upon the tavern, where they were to meet their escort to Cascaro. Its sign displayed a bunch of succulent black grapes that had no business in this sump. A coach waited outside. Built of what Loth was quite sure was iron, it terrified him, even before he wondered what sort of horse could draw such a thing. Then he saw. A great wolfish head turned to look at him, and a massive jaw packed with teeth slackened to let slip a rope of drool. The creature was larger than a bear. Its thick neck tapered into a serpentine body, which could be moved by its muscular legs or a pair of bat wings. At its side was a second monster, this one furred with grey. Their eyes were identical, embers from the womb of fire. Jaculi. The offspring of wyvern and wolf.
Stay still, Kit whispered. The bestiaries say that sudden movements make them pounce.
One of the jaculi growled. Loth wanted to make the sign of the sword, but he dared not move.
How many draconic creatures were awake in Iskallen?
The driver of the coach was an Iskall, with oiled hair.
Lord Arteloth and Lord Kitson, I presume, he said.
Kit made an incoherent noise. The driver pulled a lever, and a set of steps unfolded.
Leave the chests, he muttered. Get in.
They obeyed. Inside the coach, they found a woman awaiting them, dressed in a heavy crimson gown and a veil of black drum lace. She wore long velvet gloves, frilled at the elbow. A filigrane pomander hung at her side.
Lord Arteloth, Lord Kitson, she said in a soft voice. Loth could just make out dark eyes through the veil. Welcome to Purunta. I am Priessa Yalarigas, First Lady of the Bedchamber to Her Radiance, the Donmata Marosa of the Draconic Kingdom of Iskallen.
She was not afflicted. No one tortured by the plague could speak with so gentle a tongue.
Thank you for meeting us here, my lady, Loth endeavoured to steady his voice.
Kit squeezed into the coach beside him.
We are honoured to be received at the court of King Sigoso. His Majesty is honoured to receive you.
A whip snapped outside, and the coach jolted forward.
I confess myself surprised that Her Radiance would send such a high-ranking lady to meet us, Loth said, since this city is so full of the afflicted. If the Nameless One wishes me to surrender my life to his plague, so be it, was her even reply.
Loth clenched his jaw. To think that these people had once professed loyalty to Sabran and to Virtudom.
You will be used to horses drawing a coach, my lords, Lady Priessa continued. But it would take many days to cross Iskallen that way. Jaculi are fleet-footed and never tire.
She folded her hands on her lap. Her fingers were home to several gold rings, fitted over the gloves.
You should rest, she said. However swift our coach, we have some way to go, my lords.
Loth attempted a smile. I would prefer to watch the scenery.
As you wish.
In truth, it was too dark to see a thing out of the window, but he would not sleep with a worm lover so close. This was draconic territory. He would rise from the silk pillow of nobility and find the spy within. He would harden himself to the dangers of his mission. So while Kit nodded off, Loth sat as still as he could, eyes propped open by the sheer force of will, and made a promise to the saint. He would accept the road he had been thrust upon. He would seek out Prince Wilstan. He would reunite his queen with her father, and he would find his way home.
He could not tell if Priessa Yelariga slept or if she watched him all night long.
There was smoke in her hair. She could smell it.
Where in Virtudom did you find her? The Belfry of all places.
Footsteps.
Saint, it's Mistress Durian. Send word to Her Majesty at once, and fetch a physician.
Her tongue was an ember in her mouth. When the strangers let go of her, she plunged into a fever dream. She was a child again, shaded from the sun by the branches of the tree. The fruit hung above her head, too high for her to reach, and Jondu was calling,
Come here, Iadaz, come and see!
Then the prioress was lifting a cup to her lips, saying it was the blood of the mother. It tasted like sunlight and laughter and prayer. She had burned like this in the days that followed, burned until the fire melted away her ignorance. That day she had been born anew. When she woke, a familiar woman was at her bedside, pouring water from an ewer to her bowl.
Meg?
Margaret turned to her so quickly she almost knocked the ewer over.
Iad!
With a laugh of relief, she leaned in to kiss her brow.
Oh, thank the saint, you've been insensible for days. The physician said you had an ague, then the sweat, then the pestilence. Sabran, Iad rasped. Meg, is she well?
We must first establish if you are well.
Margaret felt her cheeks, her neck. Does anything hurt? Should I fetch a physician?
No physicians, I am perfectly all right.
Iad wet her lips.
Have you anything to drink?
Of course.
Margaret filled a cup and held it up to her mouth. Iad swallowed a little of the ale inside.
You were in the belfry, Margaret said. What were you doing up there?
Iad pieced a lie together.
I took a wrong turn in the library. I found the door to the clock tower open, and I thought I would explore. And there I was when the beast came. I suppose its dreadful fumes gave me this fever.
Before Margaret could question this, she added, Now, tell me if Sabran is all right.
Sabran is as well as I have ever seen her, and all Innis knows that Fyrdell himself could not touch her with his fire.
Where is the worm now?
Margaret returned the cup to the nightstand and soaked a cloth in the bowl.
Gone, her brows pinched. There were no deaths, but he did set fire to a few storehouses.
Captain Lintley says the city is on edge.
Sabran sent out heralds to reassure the people of her protection,
but no one can believe that a High Western has woken.
It was bound to happen, he had said. Smaller things have been stirring for some time.
Aye, but never one of the overlords.
Fortunately, most of the city has no idea that what they saw was the right wing of the Nameless One. All the tapestries depicting him are hidden away in here.
Margaret wrung out a cloth. Him and his infernal kin.
He said Cometh had already woken.
Ead took another sip of ale. And Helvisa soon.
At least the others are long dead. And of course the Nameless One himself cannot return. Not while the House of Berethna endures.
When Ead tried to sit up, her arm shook and she slumped back into the pillows. Margaret went to the door to speak to a servant before returning.
Meg, Ead said, while Margaret dabbed her brow.
I know what happened to Loth.
Margaret stilled.
He wrote to you?
No. Ead glanced towards the door.
I overheard the Duke Spiritual speaking with Sabran. Combe claims Loth has gone to Cascaro as a spy to find out what is happening there and to look for Wilson Finch. He said Loth went without permission, but I think we both know the truth of it.
Slowly, Margaret sat back. Her hand came to her middle.
Save my brother, she murmured. He is no spy. Combe has sentenced him to death.
Silence fell, broken only by the birds outside.
I told him he had,
Margaret finally said. I told him that a friendship with a queen was not the same as any other, and he needed to be careful, but Loth never listens. She raised a sad, wry smile.
My brother thinks everyone is just as good as he is.
Ea tried to find some words of comfort, but had none. Loth was in too much danger.
I know. I tried to warn him too.
She took her friend by the hand.
He may yet find his way home. You know he will not last long in Cascaro.
You could petition Combe to bring him back. You are Lady Margaret Beck.
And Combe is the Duke of Courtesy. He has more influence and wealth than I ever will.
Could you not tell Sabran yourself, then?
He had asked. She clearly has her suspicions about the story.
I cannot accuse Combe or anyone without proof of a conspiracy.
If he told Sab that Loth went by choice, and I can present no evidence to counter him, then even she can do nothing.
Ead knew Margaret was right. She tightened her grip, and Margaret released a shaking breath. Someone tapped on the door. Margaret murmured to whoever was outside. Now her sidon was quiet, and her senses blunted. Ead could not hear what they said. Her friend came back with a cup.
Cordial, she said. Tally's made it specially. Such a kind girl.
The hot gruel, sweetened to the point of sickliness, was the answer to everything in Innes. Too weak to grip the handles, Ead let Margaret spoon the awful stuff into her mouth. Another knock. This time, when Margaret opened it, she fell into a curtsy.
Leave us a moment, Meg.
Ead knew that voice. With a glance in her direction, Margaret left. The Queen of Innes stepped into her room. Her riding habit was a dark green of holly.
Call if you have need of us, Majesty, said a gruff voice from outside.
I do not think a bed-bound woman poses too much danger to my person, Sir Gules, but thank you.
The door closed. Ead sat up as best as she could, conscious of her sweat-soaked shift and the sour taste in her mouth.
Ead, Sabran said, looking over her. A flush touched her cheeks.
I see you are at last awake. You have been absent from my lodgings for too long.
Forgive me, Your Majesty.
Your generosity has been missed. I intended to call upon you earlier, but the physicians feared you might have the sweat.
The sun lightened her eyes.
You were in the clock tower the day the worm came.
I would like to know why.
Madam?
The royal librarian found you there.
Lady Oliver Marchin tells me that some courtiers and servants use the tower for venery.
I have no lover, Majesty.
I will brook no lewdness in this palace. Confess, and the Knight of Courtesy may show mercy.
He had sensed the queen would not swallow the story about taking a wrong turn.
I went up to the belfry to see if I could distract the beast from Your Majesty.
She wished she had the strength to speak with more conviction.
But I need not have feared for you.
It was the truth, stripped of its vital parts.
I trust that Ambassador Uck Isbad would not ask for a person of loose morals to be accepted into my upper household, Sebran concluded. But do not let me hear of you visiting the clock tower again. Of course, madam. The queen walked to an open window. Setting a hand on the sill, she looked out at the palace grounds. Majesty, Iad said, may I ask why you went out to face the worm? A clement breeze floated in from outside. Had Fyadel slain you, all would have been lost. Sebran did not reply for a time. He threatened my people, she murmured. I had stepped out before I had considered what else might be done. She looked back at Iad. I have received another report about you. Lady Trude Utziadur has been telling my courtiers that you are a sorceress. Damn that red-haired Gurnet. Iad almost admired her mettle, ignoring the threat of a curse. Madam, I know nothing of sorcery, she said, tinging her words with a hint of scorn. Sorcery was not a word the prioress much liked. Doubtless, Sebran said. But Lady Trude has a notion that it was you who protected me from Fyadel. She claims she saw you in the clock tower, casting a spell towards me. This time Iad was silent. There was no possible argument against the accusation. Of course, the queen said, she's a liar. Iad dared not speak. It was the saint that drove back the worm. He held forth his heavenly shield to protect me from the fire. To imply that it was cheap sorcery comes very close to treason, Sebran stated, her voice flat. I have half a mind to send her to the Dern Tower. All the tension rushed out of Iad. A laugh of relief bubbled in her, threatening to brim over. She is only young, your majesty, she said, forcing it down. With youth comes folly. She is old enough to accuse you falsely, Sebran pointed out. Do you not crave vengeance? I prefer the taste of mercy. It lets me sleep at night. Those stone-cold eyes ran her through. Perhaps you imply that I should show mercy more often? Iad was too exhausted to fear that look. No, only that I doubt Lady Trude meant insult to your majesty. More likely she has a grudge against me, since I was promoted to a position she desires. Sebran lifted her chin. You will return to your duties in 3 days. I will have the royal physician take care of you until then, she said. Iad raised her eyebrows. I need you well, Sebran continued, rising to leave. Once the announcement is made, I will need all my ladies by my side. Announcement, madam? Sebran had turned her back to her, but Iad saw her shoulders tense. The announcement, she said, of my betrothal to Albrecht Lievelin, High Prince of the Free State of Mentendon.
Chapter 12. East. The water trials passed like a long dream. Most citizens took shelter in their houses as the storm battered the west coast of Psyche, but sea guardians were expected to endure the worst conditions.
Rain is water, and so are we, the sea general called over the thunder as he marched past the ranks. His hair was plastered to his skull, and raindrops rolled off the end of his nose. If a little water can defeat you, you cannot hope to ride a dragon or guard the sea, and this is not the place for you.
He raised his voice.
Will water defeat you?
No, honored sea general,
the apprentices shouted. Tane was already dripping. At least the rain was warm. Archery and firearms were easy enough. Even in this downpour, Tane had sharp eyes and a steady hand. Damusa was best with a bow. She could have done it blindfolded. But Tane came second. None of them, not even Damusa, could best her with a pistol. But a sea guardian from the West House came close. Kanperu, the eldest and tallest, whose jaw looked as if a sword could be struck upon it, and whose hands seemed big enough to wrap around tree trunks. Mounted archery was next. They each had to hit 6 glass floats that had been hung from a beam. Damusa was not as skilled on horseback as she was on foot, and only shattered 5 of them. Not being fond of horses, Onren, who gritted her teeth throughout the trial, lost control of her steed and missed 3. Tane, however, struck true each time, until her horse stumbled and sent her final shot awry, allowing Tarosa to steal first place. They rode their horses back into the stables.
Bad luck, peasant, Tarosa said to Tane as she slid from the saddle.
I suppose some things are in the blood. Perhaps one day the honored sea general will realize that dragon riders are born, not made.
Tane set her jaw as an ostler took her stallion. Its coat was dark with rain and sweat.
Ignore him, Tane, Demusa said, dismounting.
Her hair coiled wetly about her shoulders.
The water runs the same in all of us.
Terusa curled his lip, but left. He never quarreled with the other descendants of riders. When he was gone, Tane bowed to Demusa.
You have great talent, Honorable Demusa, she said. I hope to be as skilled an archer as you one day.
Demusa bowed in return.
I hope to have the same mastery of firearms as you one day, Honorable Tane.
They left the stables together. Tane had spoken to Demusa before, but now they were alone. She found herself unsure of what to say. She had often wondered what it must have been like for her, growing up in a mansion in Ganura with her Medushi grandparents. When they reached the practice hall, they sat close to each other, and Tane set about cleaning the mud from her arrows. Kanpuru, the tall and silent apprentice, was already there, furbishing his silver-mounted pistol. As they worked, Onren entered the hall.
That, she declared, was the worst I have ever shot.
She scraped back her drenched hair.
I must find a shrine and beg the great Quiriki to wash away all horses. They have been out to thwart me since the day I was born.
Peace.
Demusa did not look up from her bow.
You have plenty of time to show your skill to the Medushi.
Easy for you to say. You have the blood of the Medushi. All of you become riders in the end.
There is always a chance that I will be the first one who does not.
A chance, Onren agreed, but we all know that chance is very small.
Her knee was swollen from the duel. She would have to work hard if she meant to be a rider. Kanpuru returned his pistol to the wall rack. As he left, he gave Onren an indecipherable look over his shoulder.
I hear the Honorable Kanpuru has taken to visiting a tavern near the fruit market, Demuso murmured to Onren. When he was out of earshot, he spends every evening there.
What of it?
I thought we might go too. When we become riders, we will all be spending a great deal of time together. It would behoove us to be well acquainted.
Would you not agree? Onren smiled.
Dumu, she said, are you trying to distract me so I won't outperform you?
You know very well you outperform me in everything but archery.
Demusa inspected her bow once more.
Come, I need to get out of this place for a few hours.
I should tell the honored sea general what a bad influence you are.
Onren stood and stretched.
Coming, Tane.
It took Tane a moment to notice that they were both looking at her, waiting for an answer. They were serious. In the middle of their water trials, they wanted to go to a tavern.
Thank you, she said slowly, but I must stay here and practice for the next water trial.
She paused. Should you not also be preparing for tomorrow, Onren? Onren snorted.
I have practiced for most of my life. Practicing last night did not help me today.
No, she said. What I need tonight is a stiff drink. And perhaps a stiff...
She glanced at Demusa, and though their lips quaked in an effort to contain it, they both laughed.
They had lost their senses. Surely at a time like this, no one could afford distractions.
I hope you enjoy your evening, Tane said, rising. Good night.
Good night, Tane, Onren said. Her smile faded and her brow furrowed.
Try to get some sleep, won't you?
Of course. Tane crossed the hall and hung up her bow. Terusa, who was about to practice unarmed combat with his friends, caught her gaze and clapped his fist into his palm. A damp breeze wafted through the corridors, warm as the steam of freshly made soup. The polished floor rattled beneath her as she strode back through the school. She washed away the sweat and practiced alone in her room with her sword. When her arm finally tired, a worm of misgiving began to eat her. There was no reason her horse should have stumbled during the trial. What if Terusa had impaired it somehow, just to spite her? In the end, she went back to the stables. When she found the farer, he assured her that there was nothing wrong. The ground had been wet. Most likely the horse had slipped.
Don't let a little shit like Terusa get the better of you, Souza had said, but her voice seemed very far away.
Tane spent what remained of the evening in the practice hall,
pockmarking scarecrows with throwing knives. Only once she could hit every single one in the eye did she let herself return to her room, where she lit an oil lamp and began her first letter to Sousa.
So far, the trials are as difficult as I feared. Today my horse slipped, and I paid the price for it. Even though I feel as if I have bled myself dry practicing, some of the others seem to perform just as well as I do without working themselves to sleeplessness. They drink and smoke and laugh with one another. But all I can do is continue to refine my skill. After 14 years of preparation, the water in me will not run true, and I am afraid, Sousa. Those 14 years are nothing here. We are judged for today, not for yesterday.
She gave it to a servant to send to Cape Hisan, then lay on her bedding and listened to the cut of her own breath. Outside, an owl hooted. After a short while, Tane got up and slipped back out of her room. She could practice a little more. The governor of Cape Hisan was a slender fellow, neat as a parcel, who lived in an illustrious mansion in the middle of the city. Unlike the chief officer, he knew how to smile. He was grey-haired with a kind face and was rumoured to be soft on petty criminals. A pity that Nicolas, having broken the cardinal rule of psyche, could by no stretch of the imagination be deemed a petty criminal.
So, the governor said, the woman brought the outsider to your door?
Yes, Nicolas confirmed. His throat was almost too dry to form words.
Yes, indeed, honored governor. I had been enjoying a cup of your remarkable Sicanese wine just moments before their arrival.
They had held him in a room for several days. He had lost count in the darkness. When soldiers had finally marched him out, he had almost fainted, thinking they were taking him straight to the block. Instead, they presented him to a physician who had checked his hands and examined his eyes. The soldiers had then given Nicolas fresh clothes and escorted him to the most powerful official in this region of Psyche.
So, you took this man into your home? Said official continued. Did you believe he was a legal satellite in Orisima?
Nicolas cleared his throat.
No. I knew everyone in Orisima. But the woman threatened me, he said, trying to appear haunted by the memory. She held a dagger to my throat, and she said that if I did not take the outsider in, she would kill me.
Pania had told him to be honest, but every good story needed a pinch of embellishment. Two foot soldiers kept watch close by. Iron helms covered their heads and napes, secured by green cords that tied beneath their chins. In unison, they slid the screens aside, letting two more soldiers into the room. They held someone between them.
Was it this woman?
The governor asked. Her hair clumped around her shoulders. One of her eyes was swollen closed. From the bloated lip on the soldier to her left, she had fought. Someone gallant would deny it.
Yes, Nicolas admitted. She gave him a hateful look. Yes, the governor echoed. She is a musician in a theatre in Cape Hisan. The all-honored warlord permits some Sicanese artists to provide entertainment and conversation on certain days in Orisima.
He raised his eyebrows.
Have you ever been visited?
Nicolas managed a strained smile.
I have generally been content with my own company.
Good, the woman spat at him. Then you can fuck yourself, silver-loving liar.
One of the soldiers struck her.
Quiet, she snapped.
Nicolas flinched. The woman crumpled to the floor where she drew in her shoulders and pressed a hand to her cheek.
Thank you for confirming that this is the woman.
The governor drew his lacquered writing box towards him.
She will say nothing of how an outsider came to be on this island. Do you know?
Nicolas swallowed. His saliva felt as thick as pottage. Honesty be damned. No matter how far away she was, he could not implicate Trude.
No, he lied. He would not say.
The governor glanced over the tops of his eyeglasses. His small dark eyes had pouches beneath them.
Learned Dr. Roos, he said, grinding an ink stick with water. I respect your knowledge, so I will be frank. If you can tell me nothing more, this woman will be tortured.
The woman began to tremble.
It is not our custom to use such methods except under the most serious circumstances. We have enough evidence to prove that she is involved in a conspiracy that may threaten the whole of Psyche. If she bought the outsider to Orisima, she must know where he came from in the first place. Therefore, she must either be in league with smugglers, which is punishable by death, or she is protecting someone else, someone who has yet to be revealed.
The governor selected a brush from his box.
If she has been used, the all-honored warlord may show mercy. Are you certain you know nothing more about Saliad's purpose here, or who might have helped him enter?
Nicolas looked at the woman on the floor. One dark eye stared up from behind her hair.
I am certain.
The moment he said it, he felt as if another truncheon had struck the breath from him.
Take her to the jailhouse, the governor said.
As the soldiers hauled her up, the woman began to gasp in panic. For the first time, Nicolas saw how young she was, no older than Trude. Janart would have been ashamed. He bowed his head, disgusted at the feel of his own skin.
Thank you, learned Dr. Roos, governor said. I suspected this state of affairs, but I required your confirmation.
When the footsteps had receded from the corridor outside, the governor spent several minutes with his head bent over his letter, during which Nicolas dared not speak.
Your psychanese is very good. I understand you taught anatomy in Orisima,
the governor finally remarked, making Nicolas start.
How did you find our students?
It was as if the woman had never existed.
I learned as much from them as they did from me, Nicolas said truthfully, and the governor smiled.
Seizing the opportunity, Nicolas added,
I am, however, very short on ingredients for other work, which the long-honored High Prince of Mentendon assured me would be provided. I also fear that the honored chief officer of Orisima has destroyed my apparatus.
The honorable chief officer can be overzealous.
The governor set down his brush.
You cannot return to Orisima until this matter is closed. It must not be known that a trespasser was able to breach its walls, and we must cleanse the trading post to ensure there is no trace of the red sickness. I am afraid I must place you under house arrest in Ganura while we conduct our investigation.
Nicolas stared at him. He could not be this fortunate. Instead of torture, they were giving him freedom.
Ganura, he repeated. For a few weeks. It is best if we remove you from the situation.
Nicolas sensed the issue as diplomatic. He had sheltered a trespasser. A Psychanese citizen in his position would be put to death for that crime. But the execution of a Mentish settler would sour the delicate alliance with the House of Lievelin.
Yes.
He tried to look contrite.
Yes, honored governor, of course. I understand.
By the time you return, I pray all this will be resolved. To thank you for your information, I will make sure you receive the ingredients you need, the governor said. But you must be silent about all that has occurred.
He dealt Nicolas a penetrating look.
Is this acceptable to you, learned Dr. Roos?
Perfectly. I thank you for your kindness.
Nicolas hesitated.
And Soliard? The trespasser is in the jailhouse. We were waiting for him to display any symptoms of the red sickness, the governor said. If he does not reveal who helped him reach Psyche, he will also be tortured.
Nicolas wet his lips.
Perhaps I could help you, he said, even as he wondered why he was willingly asking for deeper entanglement in this mess.
As a fellow man of virtudom, I may be able to make Saliard see the sense in confessing. If you would let me visit him before I go? The governor appeared to consider this.
I do not like bloodshed where it can be avoided.
Perhaps tomorrow, he conceded.
For now, I must send word of this unfortunate situation to the all-honored warlord.
He returned his attention to his writing.
Rest well this night, learned Dr. Roos.
Chapter 13 East. The next trial was with knives. Like the others, it was observed by the sea general and a group of strangers in blue robes.
other members of the clan Medushi, who had undergone their own trials 50 years ago. The people whose legacy Tane might share if her body did not fail her. Her eyes sat like pufferfish in her skull. As she picked up each knife, her hands felt slick and clumsy. She still performed better than all the apprentices but Tarosa, whose skill with these blades was what had earned him such great renown at the North House. Onryn strode into the hall, just after Tarosa had achieved a perfect score. Her hair was loose and uncombed. The Sea General raised his eyebrows, but she only bowed to him and approached the knives. Kenpuru appeared next. The Sea General raised his eyebrows even higher. Onryn took hold of a blade, found her stance, and threw it across the hall at the first scarecrow. Every knife found its mark. "A perfect score," the Sea General remarked. "But do not be late again, Honorable Onryn."
"Yes, Honored Sea General."
That night, the Sea Guardians were woken by the servants and escorted, still in their sleep robes, to a line of palanquins. Ensconced in hers, Tane chewed her nails to the quick. They emerged from their palanquins beside a vast spring-fed lake in the forest. Raindrops pinked its surface.
"Members of the High Sea Guard are often woken in the night to answer threats to Psyche. They must swim better than fish, for they may be separated at any time from their ship or from their dragon," the Sea General said. 8 dancing pearls have been scattered in this lake. Should you retrieve one, it will encourage me to rank you higher."
Tarosa was already undressing. Slowly, Tane removed her sleep robe and waded in up to her waist. 26 Sea Guardians and only 8 pearls. They would be hard to find in the darkness. She closed her eyes and released the thought. When the Sea General gave the order, she sliced into the lake. Water enfolded her. Clear, sweet water, cool against her skin. Her hair rippled around her like seaweed as she turned, straining for a glimpse of silver green. Onryn entered the lake with barely a splash. She dived, snatched her treasure, and glided upward in one graceful arc. She swam like a dragon. Determined to be next, Tane ventured deeper. The spring, she reasoned, would waft the pearls west. Turning, she descended smoothly to the lake bed and swam using only her legs, ghosting her hands through the silt as she went. Her chest was tight by the time her fingers brushed a tiny bead. She surfaced almost in unison with Tarosa, who shook back his hair and held his pearl up to inspect it.
"Dancing pearls, worn by the God-chosen," he said. "Once these were symbols of heritage of history." He bared a knife of a smile. "Now they adorn so many peasants, they might as well be dirt."
Tane looked him in the eye and said,
"You swam well, Honorable Tarosa."
That made him chuckle.
"Oh, villager, I am going to make such a fool of you that they'll never let a peasant soil Clan Medushi again."
He swam past.
"Get ready to fall."
He struck out for the edge of the lake. Tane followed at a distance. There was rumor that in the final trial, each principal apprentice would always fight another. She had already duelled Onryn. Her opponent would be either Tarosa or Demusa. If it was the former, he would do everything in his power to break her. Nicolay spent a restless night in the governor of Cape Hassan's mansion. The bedding was far more luxurious than what he had in Arisima, but rain battered the tiled roof and would not give him peace. On top of that, it was insufferably humid, as it always was in the Sykanese summer. Sometime in the small hours, he rose from the clammy heap of bedding and moved the window screen aside. The breeze was warm and thick as cordial, but at least he could see the stars and think. No educated person could believe in ghosts. Quacks professed that the spirits of the dead lived in an element called ether, pure drivel. Yet there was a whisper in his ear that he knew to be Janet, telling him that what he had done to that musician was a crime. Ghosts were the voices of the dead left behind, echoes of a soul taken too soon. Janot would have lied to keep the musician safe. Then again, Janot had been good at lying. Most of his life had been a performance. 30 years of lying to Trude, to Osgard, and of course, to Aladdin. Nicolay shivered. A chill rumbled through his belly when he remembered the look in her eyes at the entombment. She had known all along.
She had known, and said nothing.
"It is not her fault my heart belongs to you," Janot had told him once, and he had spoken true. Like many unions among those of noble blood, theirs had been arranged by their families. The betrothal had been sealed the day Janot turned 20, a year before Nicolas had met him. He had not been able to face going to the wedding. The knot in the strings of their fates had tortured him. If only he had arrived at court sooner, they might have been companions. He snorted, as if the Marquess of Zeador would have been allowed to wed a penniless nobody from Rosenton. Aladine had been a commoner, but her hand in marriage had come with jewels on it. Nicolas, fresh out of university, would have brought the family nothing but debt. Aladine must be past 60 by now. Her auburn hair would be laced with silver, her mouth framed by lines. Oscard was at least 40. Saint, how the years flew. The breeze did nothing to cool him down. Defeated, he closed the screen and lay back on the bedding. The warmth basted his skin. He willed himself to sleep, but his mind refused to quieten, and a low fire burned in his ankle. By morning, there was no sign of the storm ending. He watched it water the grounds of the mansion. The servants brought him bean curd, grilled loach, and barley tea to break his fast. At noon, a servant informed him that the governor had granted his request. He was to visit Trium Sulliard in the jailhouse, and mine what information he could from the boy. The servants also provided him with a new walking cane, made of a stronger, lighter wood. He begged a little water of them. They brought it to him in a gourd. A closed palanquin took him to the jailhouse at dusk. Safe inside his box, Nicolas peered through the blinds. In 7 years, he had never taken a step into Cape Hissan. He had heard its music and its chatter, glimpsed its lights, like fallen stars, and longed to walk its streets. But it had remained a mystery to him. His world had been closed in a fist of high walls. The lantern light revealed a bustling city. In Arisima, he had been surrounded by reminders of Mentendon. Now he remembered just how far from home he was. No western settlement smelled of cedarwood or sinking incense. No western settlement sold squid ink or iridescent floats for fishing. And of course, no western city paid tribute to dragons. Signs of their presence were everywhere. Merchants touted amulets on every corner, promising luck and succor from the lords of sea and rain. Almost every street housed a driftwood shrine and a basin of salt water. The palanquin stopped outside the jailhouse. Once it was unlocked, Nicolas climbed out and slapped a gnat away from his face. A pair of prison sentinels hurried him through the gate. The first thing that hit him was the eye-watering odour of shit and piss. He gathered one sleeve to his nose and mouth. When they passed the execution ground, the strength deserted his legs. Rotting heads were displayed on a stand, tongues swollen like curl grubs. Sulliard had been hidden in an underground room. He lay prone in his cell, a cloth around his waist. The sentinels were good enough to hand Nicolas a lantern before they left. Their footsteps receded into the black. Nicolas knelt and gripped one of the wooden bars. "Sulliard," he rapped his cane on the floor. "Look lively." Nothing. Nicolas slotted his cane through the bars and gave Sulliard a firm prod. He stirred. "Trude," he murmured. "Sorry to disappoint. It's Roos." There was a pause. "Dr. Roos." Sulliard unfolded himself. "I thought I was dreaming."
"Would that you were."
Sulliard was in bad shape. His face had bloated like dough in the oven, and his brow had been inked with the characters for trespasser. Dried blood lathered his back and thighs. Sulliard had no protection from a prince across the sea. Nicolas might have been shocked by the brutality once, but the nations of Virtudom use crueler means to tangle the truth from prisoners. "Sulliard," Nicolas said, "tell me what you told the questioners."
"Only the truth," Sulliard coughed, "that I came ashore to beg the warlord for help."
"Not about that, about how you reached Arisima." Nicolas pressed closer.
"The other woman, the first woman you saw, the one on the beach, did you tell them about her?"
"No." It was all Nicolas could do to not wring the blockhead by the throat. Instead, he opened the gourd.
"Drink."
He pushed it between the bars. "The first woman took you to the theatre district instead of reporting you.
It was her crime that landed you in Orisima. You must be able to describe her. Her face, her clothes, something. Help yourself, Soliard.
A blood-streaked hand reached for the gourd.
She had long, dark hair and a scar at the top of her left cheek, like a fish hook.
Soliard drank.
I think that she was of an age with me, or younger. She wore sandals and a coat of grey cloth over a black tunic.
Offer this information to your captors, Nicolaes urged, in exchange for your life. Help them find her and they may show mercy.
I beseeched them to listen to me.
Soliard seemed delirious.
I said I came from Her Majesty, that I was her ambassador, that my ship foundered. None of them would listen.
Even if you were a real ambassador, which you clearly are not, they would not welcome you.
Nicolaes glanced over his shoulder. The sentinels would soon come back for him.
Listen carefully now, Soliard. The governor of Cape Hassan is sending me to the capital while this matter is investigated. Let me take your message to the warlord.
Fresh tears filled his eyes.
You would do that for me, Dr. Roos.
If you tell me more about your undertaking, tell me why you believe Sobran needs an alliance with Psyche.
He had no idea if he would be able to keep his word, but he needed to know exactly why this boy was here, what Trude had conspired with him to do.
Thank you.
Soliard reached between the bars and took Nicolaes by the hand.
Thank you, Dr. Roos. The Knight of Fellowship blessed me with your company.
I'm sure, Nicolaes said dryly.
He waited. Soliard squeezed his hand and lowered his voice to the barest whisper.
Trude and I,
he began.
We believe the Nameless One will awaken very soon. That the endurance of the House of Berethnet was never what kept him imprisoned. That come what may, he will return. And that is why his servants have been stirring. They are answering his call.
His lips trembled as he spoke. Expressing the idea that the House of Berethnet was not what kept the Nameless One at bay was high treason in Virtudom.
What led you to believe this?
Nicolaes asked, stumped.
What doomsinger has frightened you, boy? Not a doomsinger. Books. Your books, Dr. Roos.
Mine?
Yes. The books on alchemy you left behind,
Soliard whispered.
Trude and I were planning to find you in Orisima. The Knight of Fellowship took me to your side. Do you not see that this is a divine mission?
No, I do not, you witless cabbage, but you really thought the rulers of the East would be more sympathetic to this mad-born proposal than Sobran?
Nicolaes sneered.
You thought you would cross the abyss and risk your heads because the two of you leafed through a few books on alchemy? Books that take alchemists decades, if not lifetimes, to understand, if they ever do.
He almost pitied Soliard for his folly. He was young and love-drunk. The boy must have convinced himself that he was like Lord Wolf Glen or Sir Antor Dale, the romantic heroes of Innish history, and must honour his lady by charging headlong into danger.
Please, Dr. Roos, I beg you, hear me. Trude does understand those books. She believes there is a natural balance in the world, as ancient alchemists did.
Soliard prattled on.
She believes in your work, and she believes she has found a way to apply it to our world. To our history.
Natural balance. He was referring to the words scored into the long-lost tablet of Rumalabar, words that had fascinated alchemists for centuries. What is below must be balanced by what is above, and in this is the precision of the universe. Fire ascends from the earth, light descends from the sky. Too much of one doth inflame the other, and in this is the extinction of the universe.
Soliard, Nicolaes said through his teeth. No one understands that wretched tablet. This is guesswork and folly. I was not convinced at first either. I was in denial. But when I saw the passion in Trude...
Soliard tightened his grip.
She explained it to me. That when the worms lost their flame and fell into their long sleep, the eastern dragons grew strong. Now they are losing their strength once more, and the draconic breeds are awakening. Do you not see? It is a cycle.
Nicolaes looked again at that earnest face.
Sulliard was not the author of this mission. Trude. It was Trude. Her heart and her mind were the soil it had sprung from. How like her grandsire she had become. The obsession that had killed him had lived.